Papa? Papa, can you hear me?
We are back. We are back, and it's Omni Talks After the Fast Five for April 7th, 2018. I'm here as always with two of my favorite people, Ann Mazinga and Carter Jensen. Say hi, guys.
Hello.
I still think that's a joke, the thing that's the mic test, but here we are.
Yeah, so funny anecdote. Ann and I have been on the road the last few weeks, and so we were taping from the road, and every podcast I would start with, Papa, can you hear me? And then we'd send it to Carter for production, and he'd always edit it out, thinking it was fake, that we were just testing the mics. But in reality, it was real, so we're trying it out today.
So audience, sorry I deprived you of that last few weeks.
It's okay.
It's probably the smart move, Carter. But anyway, hope you guys like it. We'll see if it takes on, we'll make it the signature, but we thought we'd give it a shot today. We just thought it was funny. We're excited to be here. It's cold as hell outside. It's like a wind tunnel down 9th Street in downtown Minneapolis. But we're ready to get going. So I'd love to get to the stories. But first, I do want to touch on our sponsor for the week. Our sponsor is Delivery Solutions. Delivery Solutions is the platform that delights its customers with click-to-door delivery. If you want to learn more, visit www.deliverysolutions.co. So just to run down the stories from the Fast Five this week, we had Walmart actually making some good moves. We had shopping malls having their highest vacancy rate in a number of years. We had a lot of activity in the resale market. We had a report on retail and the extent to which it supports American jobs. And finally, we closed out the week with a story on Amazon Spark and how it was not taking hold with consumers, brands, or advertising agencies. So let's get right to it. I think of those top five, I think actually the one that probably has the most bearing on how the future of retail will unfold is actually the Spark story. So I want to go, Carter, to you first on this one. Carter, what was your take on that story?
Yeah, so Spark, I think the interesting thing here is the fact that I don't think a lot of people even know what Spark is.
I was going to ask you that, Carter. Before we go into it, I'm going to raise my hand and be the ignorant one in the room who's like, Spark,
so
enlighten me.
Spark, as many of you probably don't even know, is loaded on every single person's phone who actually has the Amazon app already loaded in. So the Amazon iOS app, and I wish you know the exact date, it's almost about a year ago now, quietly introduced this new thing called Spark. And it was accessed through a couple clicks through the side tab. So it was not necessarily this huge rollout. But the idea was that they were ultimately trying to copy Instagram. So I kind of think it's a twofold thing. So the first reason I think they did it was, one, to kind of grab users' attention and spark inspiration actually within a platform that Amazon owns. So they wanted users to say, hey, I got some downtime sitting waiting for the bus. Hey, I'm waiting for this guy at the deli to make me my sandwich. And you're cruising through, and instead of cruising through Instagram, Amazon potentially thought that you might want to cruise through their new platform, Spark. It's a visually-based Instagram look like, and ultimately they were hoping that would inspire you to purchase something. There's some incredible numbers around how people are connected with brands around Instagram, and I think they were looking to duplicate that within a platform that was closer to the actual purchase of Amazon. The other really interesting thing I heard when it first came out was this idea that you look at some of the Amazon customers, and I think some of our listeners can attest to this, but you're almost at a point sometimes when you kind of, and it's kind of weird saying it, but you have everything you need. Like, what else do you need on Amazon? What else do you want to purchase? And you're sitting there at 9 o'clock at night cruising through Amazon saying, well, I got all the basics. I have all the clothes I need. I have all the toiletries that I might want from Amazon. My refrigerator is full. We're very blessed people. We live in that world. But how can Amazon inspire you to buy more? Like, how can they create a platform that ultimately knows you better than you know yourself, that will serve up products that you might not even know that you need? And how can Amazon make that happen? So that's a little bit more on the fringe, but it's a fascinating point of view that I've read a couple different places.
So Carter, juxtapose that then with Facebook, and juxtapose that within the context of commerce. Compare and contrast for us to Ann's question, what is the approach Facebook's taking? What is the approach that Amazon's trying to take, given what you just said about Spark? How do those two compare? Why are they doing it? How does that all make sense in the world of commerce and retail?
Yeah, you talked about explicit versus implicit, right? And I think everyone is aware, especially in the world we live in the last couple months, how much Facebook knows about you and how much, you know, Facebook is able to kind of rent that time and rent that knowledge to brands and retailers to kind of meet you on that platform. So, Facebook's really been able to take that and then target in really unique ways. Amazon is so much closer to the purchase. They are so much more literal in terms of, hey, I know what you have purchased in the last 12 months. I know how quickly that you use the ketchup that's in your refrigerator. I know exactly what size of t-shirt you wear. And so they're kind of coming from almost a little bit more literal place in terms of being able to target some of these ad executions or ad strategies. So I think Facebook's a little further away from the actual purchase, but at the end of the day, they probably know more about your soul than Amazon does. But Amazon knows exactly how much ketchup you have left in your refrigerator, which is something I don't think we can ignore either.
And they're both trying to chase this horizontal line, right? Like this full experience from social network all the way to the endpoint being commerce. Amazon starts with commerce. They're trying to get to the social network on the other end of the horizontal. Facebook starts with social networking. They want to get to commerce on the other side of the horizontal.
Hands
is that right?
Down. Yeah. It's an interesting slide. We actually talked about a Q4, which is interesting because we talk about Facebook having a huge portion of users day in and day out, right? We spend a little bit over an hour on a Facebook-owned social platform as a U.S. consumer base every single day. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to enable users to actually execute purchases without ever leaving their platform, right? So they're introducing ad units and ad strategies where us as a retailer, us as a brand can dive in and say, hey, we're not only going to target an ad in your feed, we're going to allow you to click on it, and we're actually going to allow you to transact, enter your credit card details, and actually, take care of all of that without ever leaving the Facebook platform. And they're doing that for a few different reasons, and I think it comes down to that, they make money, they're selfish, they want to make sure that no one ever leaves a Facebook-owned platform. Amazon's coming the other way, right? So Facebook's kind of pushing towards that commerce. Amazon has been a master in commerce for years now. They've mastered that, but they don't necessarily have the same grasp on attention that we're seeing Facebook have, right? So you're not necessarily scrolling through Facebook while you're sitting in, Amazon when you're sitting in line for the deli. You're not scrolling through Amazon necessarily when the bus. It's more purposeful driven. I'm going to open Amazon because I need to order A, B, and C. But if you look at what Amazon's been doing over the last few years, they've been trying to move the other way. As you mentioned, Chris, they've been trying to go more towards what are we going to introduce that allows or enables you or entices you to spend more time on the platform closer to that purchase. And you can go even as far as, Amazon Music, the new kind of Amazon, movies and the media stuff they're doing. And then when you look at Alexa, you might not think that you're spending active time embracing, and this is a good debate,
another
right?
Example of them going but, after this.
But blanketing 24/7 when you're sitting in the home, getting you about as close to purchase as you possibly can get. And it's a good topic we could talk forever about.
No, I think it's good. I'll close it up here with that. Thank you for that. I mean, I think it's a really interesting conversation to me for a few reasons. I think, first of all, Amazon is great, but they are still vulnerable to some degree, and they're vulnerable in the sense of what you're talking about, which is they're vulnerable on our unconscious. Amazon has a really good understanding of explicitly and consciously what we want, what we search for. But where Facebook, and why I'm still long on them, regardless of everything that's coming in the media, Facebook owns, it's really, the way I like to say it usually is, Facebook actually owns our memories. And Facebook in some ways owns our unconscious. Okay, when our birthdays are, what events we're going to, things that we're doing that we don't even know that we're doing them. And Alexa's trying to get at this to some degree too. But they know, they own our unconscious. And I've coined this term, I haven't heard anyone else use it, but to me, I call that implicit search versus what's happening in Amazon, which is explicit search, which is why so many product searches are happening on Amazon. But that implicit versus explicit difference in how those things merge and come together over time, that honestly is, those are the company that figures that out, that's the eggs whose basket I'm putting, or that's the basket I'm putting my eggs in, because I think that's going to be key in terms of how everything unfolds. All right, so let's go to our next. Ian, I'm curious, what resonated with you from this week, if anything?
Well, actually, I think the ThredUp story is one of the interesting ones that I was looking into also this week. And a connection point there is the Century 21 stores. They're opening a small format store in New York, a 5,000 square foot space where, Century 21, for those of you who don't know, is an off-price retailer. They're one of the oldest off-price retailers. They started in Manhattan. Their store was destroyed in 9/11, and they rebuilt a store and are building this small format version now nearby. And one thing that they're doing is kind of attacking this this luxury resale market. So they've invited a partner company, LXR Inc., which traditionally right now is going into department stores and these off-price retailers, and they're providing resold handbags and accessories. So think that Louis Vuitton bag that somebody used twice and now are putting back into the resale market. Now when you go to Century 21, they're going to have those vintage or resale products alongside and in displays with their off-price merchandise. And so I think this is going to really start to explore what these off-price retailers that are having great years. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Ross Stores included. That's where people are going right now. And what I think Century 21 is doing that will be a really interesting tell for the future of these off-price retailers is creating a more curated, small-format store that's incorporating another reason that people are going to their stores. They're already going for that treasure hunt to find the 70% off Gucci handbag. But now they're also allowing people to come in and leverage that their store as a place to touch and feel and try on these vintage or resold goods.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, the resale market is just booming right mm-hmm. now. And, I think it makes sense. I mean, even as you were talking, I think back to Netflix, how we went from, let's all buy our DVDs, right? And say, no, you know what? It's just smarter. Let's just, like, have a few with us all the time and just put that kind of on a rental plan and let's go from there. And then, suddenly that changes even further. But that mindset's going to hit other industries. You see it coming. I talked a lot about it in the Fast Five breakdown itself. But yeah, new business models like that, they're fascinating in terms of how they're going to emerge. How do you think about that? And because I know you've done a lot of research on this, especially given the story around malls, and both you and I have taken a lot of flack, especially from our family in terms of just the negative opinion that we have on malls right now. How do you guys think about that mall story? And I know you've been conducting some research. What do you think about it? And what purposes do malls still serve in this world?
Yeah, I've been, just to give the listeners a little bit of background, I've been doing some research, just kind of observing who's still going to the malls and what purpose they serve. And I think what I've been finding is fascinating. You cannot deny people are still going to the malls, but when you go to the malls, especially, the non-tourist destination malls, so the average Joe America malls that you're talking about in the Fast Five, it's sad, to be honest. I mean, especially as someone who grew up going to the malls and, meeting your friends there on a Saturday and spending the entire day
there. And for the record, when Anne says sad, she went to a mall every single weekend for like about 6 weeks and sat out in front of the children's place just to see what was happening.
Right.
So actually, I don't know what's sadder, that or the fact that the mall is kind of the way it is. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, thanks for making me feel bad about myself, Chris.
Oh, deserved.
It was in the name of research.
Right, right.
No, I think that, you see rows and rows of stores that are completely shuttered. I mean, they're lights off, and it really even more depressing is that nobody's doing anything to, like, curtain off or try to make it look like. I mean, you saw a couple malls where it's like, we've got space to fill and an advertisement outside, but they're not even trying anymore. It's just empty rooms that are, that still have the Hot Topic stickers on the walls and nothing's been in there for months. But I think, we are seeing the rise of some more entertainment-based things going into these empty stalls. And whether or not those will survive, I guess we'll see. But they're certainly targeting experiences for the people that are still going to malls. So families on the weekends and even, the boomer crowd that's still, walking around the malls and getting their exercise there, moms with their kids. Those experience stores, I think, we'll see an increase in.
So from your research, if you could sum up in one word, why are people still going to malls? What would it be? What would that one word be?
I think people are still going to malls for the social experience.
Social. So that's really different. I mean, that's different than product acquisition. That's different than commercial. So
right.
What does that mean for the infrastructure of the malls, the businesses they put into those infrastructures. That's interesting. Carter, were you?
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I'm all behind the shift towards the experience-based kind of tenants within these malls. And I think we've seen success in that in things like the Mall of America we have here in our backyard. And we obviously see some of the more regional malls that are having a really hard time kind of finding that. I would just be curious what we think of when I look at kind of these experience-based tenants. I see kind of two different sides of it. I see tenants that are all experience. It's the go-kart, laser tag, the Barbie experience, like all of that kind of, or Crayola experience, and they used to have a Barbie museum there. But then you also see retailers who are still focused on selling things, but have transformed the experience within that footprint to match or to still be in parallel. And I guess I'd be curious what we think of that. Like, do we think the future is still going to include a mix of those things? Do we think the mall is still going to be about buying things, or is it going to be just a big theme park?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Anne and I talk a lot about this. I'll let her, I think she can expand upon it better than I can, but just to tee it up, I think it's still going to be about the trendy things, right? It's still going to, if the malls that are going to exist and stay around, it's still going to be about those trendy products. But it's not going to be just about the products. The retailers that are going to survive are going to have that trend that goes with them, have the brand that goes with them. But they are creating an experience or a reason you want to go there. And I know there's a few of those brands that are top of mind for Anne. So, Anne, why don't you
share those? I think you're dead on, Carter. I think what we're going to start to see is that malls, as they try to continue to attract that retail guest, the store concept is going to have to shift from strictly product sales, you know, 1,000 things on the rack and 2 associates that are in there helping you, to an experience-based shopping experience. So how are you inspiring them to come in there? I think the van store is a good example. The van store could be, you know, their main target is teenagers and millennials. But their store is more about the art that's on the walls, the skateboards that have been designed by local artists. I think you're looking at how they're getting people to really be inspired and walk through the store and spend time there. And then if they happen to leave with an item or a skateboard that's been designed by a local artist, great. But it's really about giving them that experience. And I think another example would be Lululemon. You see Lululemon having classes in the store. They're having experts that are, you know, helping you pick out the leggings that you're going to wear to your next yoga class. They talk about fabrics. They have programs that are trying to get, experts in the fitness industry to provide instant feedback in exchange for a discounted product deal. They're really working to create that experiential store, and it's going to have to be something that retailers are going to do if they're going to survive, especially in a mall.
That's a great example. I can't remember if we joked about this aside or if we talked about this before, but yeah, what Lululemon does with their store and the people that are working in it and the experience, I mean, it's like, for me, when I go in there, it's like being invited to sit at the cool kids' lunch table at high school. It's just, you know, and that's the type of feeling you need to connote. That gives you a reason for wanting to go there. I wanted to go to the lunch table, for example. Now, I never personally got invited, but that's another story for another day. But those are the types of experiences, to your point, Carter, I think that you need to create. That's an awesome example, Anne.
Especially as they're getting younger, younger buyers in. So the Lululemon example, again, you know, they're getting people, yeah, girls that are 8, 9, and 10. They started an entire line to target that group and then carry through that customer base through their, you know, 40s and 50s even. People will still go to that store for the experience and for that inclusivity that they feel when they go into the store.
So I'm going to and we're not going to be able to fully go into this just because of time. And it's a comment on this that is very not based, is very not me. You guys will think of this as kind of surprising. But Anne, you talk about these experiences. You talk about the things that bring people in. You talk about how people are adding value. And I feel it's all around, like, or a big part of it's a store employee. And today in the Fast Five, we talk about how a huge portion of people started in retail, but that's a concern as we continue to look at all the automation through technology. Do we still think that, do people still have a hope? Or we know technology is enabling a replacement and customization in a different way, but also we still have really kind of this human to human, like you look at some of the most successful retail environments and they're loaded with sales associates, trained, very well-paid sales associates as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and maybe we end on this. I think yes, but I'd say yes and. So it's still the sales associate, and we always talk about this in a lot of our work outside in terms of some of the advisory and consulting work we do, but the future of retail is really about three things. It's about the blend of the human, the physical, and by that I mean the operational, the architectural decisions that a retailer makes, and also the digital decisions. It's how all three of those things come together. So yes, the sales associate is still important, but I think given to the other story in the Fast Five in terms of just the amount of Americans that have jobs in retail, it's still a very real phenomenon that as that intersection of those three things come together and digital becomes a more important part of that story, it is likely that that probably means less retail jobs. The sales associates that have jobs will probably need to be paid more. They will need to be more skilled. We already know there's becoming that retailers have less need for space, and if you have less need for space, that means less jobs too. So regardless of how important that personal touch is of that person, I still think it's likely that we're still looking at a future where there's less jobs. And so how do we start to prepare for it? So on that note, let's get you out on a high note. Just a couple housekeeping things. We will be at Home Delivery World in Atlanta on April 18th. If you happen to be out there, please hit me up. Let me know on Twitter, LinkedIn. Email us at info@redarcherretail.com. We'd love to meet with you. Thanks, of course, as always, to our sponsor, Delivery Solutions. And as always, be careful out there.